any of these countries that are doing manipulating the international institutions and using them to attack Venezuela. We are waiting for Michelle Bachelet, who is the High Commissioner of Human Rights of the United Nations, to visit Venezuela.
Michelle Bachelet, the former president of Chile, she's a torture survivor herself.
Yes, she is. And she's been invited by President Maduro, and we're waiting for her to come to Venezuela and to see the situation by herself. Of course, this is part of the warfare against Venezuela, but as I told you, this is going to be part of the past, Amy. These governments, right-wing governments in Latin America, are going to be over. Some of them this year, some of them next year, and Venezuela is going to be there. At least the
revolution. How do you explain this right-wing wave throughout Latin America? Of course, excluding Mexico.
Yes, Mexico, Bolivia, Nicaragua, the Caribbean nations, they have popular governments as well. Uruguay, of course, has a progressive government as well. But it's part of the cycles, no? It's part of the cycles. But I must say that the United States was focused on the Middle East after 9/11, and they invested all these funds and money, and suddenly the progressive governments became majority in Latin America. And when they turned their head, they said, hey, what's happening here? We have to do something. We have to do a coup d'etat in Honduras because this Zelaya is trying to do a progressive government. We have to fund the candidates of the right. We have to. So they have had success until now. But the peoples of Latin America are seeing, are witnessing this, and they will change the conditions. They will change because the peoples have the right to be in power in Latin America.
Jorge Arriaza, Venezuelan foreign minister. He was here in New York to meet with the UN Secretary General. He's also the former vice president of Venezuela and the son-in-law of the late President Hugo Chavez. That does it for our broadcast. Happy birthday to Edith Penty. If you'd like to sign up for our daily digest each day, you can text the word Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. Or go to our website and sign up at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The time is 5:01, and you're listening to KBOO News Special.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, U.S. reproductive rights are under attack.
Locally, Joanne Hardesty fights for Portlanders.
And in international news, Sudanese police fired live ammunition into a crowd of mourners.
This is KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 18th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. The state of Oregon loses $175 million every year in corporate tax money because of offshore investments. That's according to a study released by the Public Information Research Group this week. The report said that nationally, states lost $17 billion every year. Oregon's two largest corporations, Intel and Nike, hold billions of dollars in offshore investments. Intel is believed to hold $46 billion in profits overseas, although they dispute that number. Nike holds $12.2 billion offshore. Oregon State Representative Rob Nossi, a Democrat from Portland, has introduced a bill in the legislature that would require reporting of income during the upcoming legislative session.
It's day 27 of the partial government shutdown, and most Americans blame Trump. That's according to a number of polls this week. Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez took to the House floor this morning to chastise the president for forcing a government shutdown because he couldn't get his way. She called it an erosion of democracy and said this shutdown is not and has never been about a border wall or border security. Here's a clip of Ocasio-Cortez speaking on the House floor today.
Today I rise to tell the story of one of my constituents, Yahi Obed.
Thank you.
Mr. Obed was born in Yemen and came to the United States when he was 8 years old. His childhood dream was to become a pilot, and he knew and felt that in the United States all things are possible, and his dream could come true. Mr. Obed's dream did come true. He's been a federal employee for 14 years, has two children, and a mortgage for his home in the Morris Park neighborhood of the Bronx. He studied hard, got his pilot's license, and is now an air traffic controller supervisor at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York City. I spoke with Mr. Obed today over the phone. He and air traffic controllers like him across the country missed their first paycheck this past week. He was telling me about how stressful his job is. Every single day, air traffic controllers have thousands of people's lives in their hands. With weather changes, flight delays, staffing complexities, and a myriad of other issues, their days almost never go exactly to plan. His job is to find solutions, analyze, and adapt in real time to keep people safe in one of the busiest airspaces in the United States and the world. And it is terrifying to think that almost every single air traffic controller in the United States is currently distracted at work because they don't know when their next paycheck is coming. Federal workers' jobs are stressful enough. The rise in New York City's cost of living is stressful enough. The fact that Mr. Obed's family cannot be reunified due to fears over the Muslim ban is stressful enough. His several thousand dollar a month Bronx mortgage is stressful enough. The anti-immigrant sentiment of this administration is stressful enough. And the truth of this shutdown is that it's actually not about a wall. It is not about the border, and it is certainly not about the well-being of everyday Americans. The truth is, this shutdown is about the erosion of American democracy and the subversion of our most basic governmental norms. It is not normal to hold 800,000 workers' paychecks hostage. It is not normal to shut down the government when we don't get what we want. It is not normal for public servants to run away and hide from the public that they serve. And it is certainly not normal to starve the people we serve for a proposal that is wildly unpopular among the American people. Each and every member of this body has a responsibility to this nation and to everyone in the United States of America, whether they voted for us or not. And this president shares in that responsibility as well, which means he has a responsibility to my constituent, Mr. Obed. President Trump has a responsibility to all air traffic controllers, FDA inspectors, TSA workers, and he has a responsibility to maintain the basic functioning of the United States government. Thank you very much, Madam Speaker. I yield my time.
That was Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This morning, Ocasio-Cortez and a group of freshman Democrats did a rare move and entered the Senate looking to find Mitch McConnell and push him into voting to reopen the government.
Donald Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, admitted he lied to Congress about efforts to build a Trump Tower in Russia. A BuzzFeed News report says Cohen told investigators that he lied to lawmakers about the real estate project at Trump's direction. During the campaign, Trump repeatedly said he had no business in Russia. Cohen's new admission shows that this claim was an outright lie. A number of Democrats have called for Trump's resignation over what they have called, quote, the bombshell admission, end quote, by Cohen. This comes a day after Cohen said that he paid to rig online polls during the 2016 election campaign at the direction and for the sole benefit of Donald Trump. Cohen admitted to paying between $12,000 and $13,000 to the owner of Redfinch Solutions, LLC, to manipulate online polls in Trump's favor.
Also in Washington, D.C. today, hundreds of indigenous people representing communities from all over the world came together for the first ever Indigenous People's March. The event was described by observers as, quote, breathtaking, heartbreaking, strong, and beautiful. Native leaders came dressed in traditional regalia and met outside of the Department of Interior, which oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the federal government. The march aimed to call attention to injustices faced by indigenous people and to demand an end to human-caused climate change. As one speaker put it, quote, if the water is rising, so must we.
Removing the Portland police force from the FBI-led JTTF, also known as the Joint Terrorism Task Force, could be a huge step toward healing fears of the community, according to Joanne Hardesty, City Commissioner. She stated that there is little to no proof that Portland's involvement with the JTTF has enhanced protection from terrorist threats. Quote, we just don't know how much data the FBI is collecting, what they're doing with that data, and how they're using it to have an impact on community members, end quote. Here's a short statement made by a former JTTF agent.
All that was necessary, according to the Inspector General, to justify the investigation. An agent speculating that the people they wanted to investigate might commit a crime in the future. And I would argue that everybody in this room might commit a crime in the future. So why was it that they picked these particular political activists? And I would argue that it was because the agents didn't like their advocacy.
The JTTF surveillance of targeted communities based on ethnicity or religion is a critical concern, and many feel this encroaches on Portlanders' peace of mind and safety. Hardesty stated that, quote, on the campaign trail, what I heard over and over again from people was their sense of insecurity just walking around Portland, end quote.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special edition of the new KABU Community Report. We're not going to be airing Counterspin this evening. At 6, it is Bread and Roses with Rachel Hartley. Self-care is the topic this evening. Then at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather, it's going to be cloudy, overcast with a shower, low near 45, and rainfall around a quarter of an inch. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy, overcast with a 40% chance of precipitation and a high of 53 degrees. Now for today in history, we celebrate the birthday of Dr. Daniel Hale Williams. He was born in 1856, and Dr. Williams was an African-American who successfully performed the first ever open-heart surgery in America. Today, Williams' work as a pioneering physician and advocate for African-American presence in medicine continues to be honored by institutions worldwide. The quote of the day is from Dambisa Moyo, author of the book Dead Aid. Here's your quote. This is my favorite thing about being raised in Africa. We don't do labels very well. We don't do this, oh, you're a Democrat, oh, you're a Republican, because we live in the real world.
As access to reproductive care for women has become increasingly tenuous and education about reproductive health is restricted, several states are seeing the effects of this lack of care and knowledge. In Arizona, police are investigating the death of a baby girl who was found in the restroom of an Amazon warehouse. The newborn was apparently born in the bathroom to an employee, then placed in a trash bin. Reporters covering the issue say these are signs of a growing trend in which a combination of ignorance and lack of care lead pregnant people to desperation. In Tennessee this week, the last clinic in Nashville announced that they have stopped providing abortions. So although technically there is still legal abortion in Tennessee, people have to drive 3 hours to get to an abortion and have a 48-hour waiting period in which they have to go to the doctor twice. Robin Marty, who has covered reproductive rights as a reporter for over a decade, has published a handbook for a post-Roe v. Wade America. Marty says it's not hard to imagine a country in which pregnant people may need to travel across state lines, obtain illegal abortion-inducing medications, or keep their abortion secret from partners, family, and the authorities. The book release comes in the midst of today's annual anti-abortion rally in Washington, D.C., in which an unprecedented televised live address from Trump was broadcast to attendees. Tomorrow, supporters of reproductive rights across the country are holding rallies in support of women and other people facing unwanted pregnancies. In Portland, the rally will take place from 1 to 4 p.m. in Pioneer Courthouse Square. More information can be found on the KBOO Facebook page under events.
Hundreds of thousands of federal workers are turning to friends, family, credit card debt, and GoFundMe to pay the bills. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has told states they can't offer unemployment benefits to federal employees who are required to report to work without pay during this government shutdown. California Governor Gavin Newsom says that he will go against the federal mandate and will offer the workers unemployment pay. Newsom said the letter sent to states by the U.S. Department of Labor was, quote, jaw-dropping and extraordinary. He explained that California will offer the workers unemployment coverage despite the federal government telling the state it can't do so for workers that are still on the job. Newsom says he believes California is on strong legal footing for this action.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An Alaska Native writer from the Norton Sound region is being honored by the state of Alaska. She hopes the award will inspire Alaska Native people. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports.
Although she has had less time to write lately, with the birth of her son almost 7 months ago, Lorelei Ivanoff of Unalakleet continues to reach wide-ranging audiences with her writing. Ivanoff's most recent piece from October, The Bearded Seal My Son May Never Hunt, was published in the New York Times. Now the nationally published writer is being recognized by the state through a Governor's Arts and Humanities Award. For Ivanoff, this honor was surprising, humbling, and even a little awkward.
In our communities and in where we live, we're taught by example to be humble and not to bring attention to ourselves. And so to receive this award, and, you know, it's a governor's award, it's a little uncomfortable for me.
This is not the first time, though, that Ivanoff's writing has put her in the spotlight. She says she's even been nominated for a Governor's Arts and Humanities Award in the past. But this time around, the Unalakleet resident sees a nice change of pace, with writings from an Alaska Native being recognized in this way. The award committee statement mentions that Ivanoff's stories are written from and about her home in Unalakleet, which provides a sense of place and connection. Ivanoff says she hopes her award will inspire other Alaska Natives and Indigenous people to be writers, too.
I feel like oftentimes that I'm the only Alaska Native writer at this point. There's not a lot being published by Alaska Natives. And so I just hope that more voices come to the forefront, more people study journalism, and more get into the media, because the way our communities are portrayed is very important.
It will be a family affair when Ivanoff formally accepts her award next month in Juneau, as she plans to bring along her husband, her baby boy, and her daughter, who will be a high school graduate by the time of this award ceremony. Reporting in Nome,
I'm Davis Havi.
A member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation is helping Native women access menstrual supplies. Claire Donnelly has more.
Eva Marie Carney founded the Kwek Society about a year ago. Kwek means women in the Potawatomi language. The organization sends pads, tampons, and underwear to 11 schools in Oklahoma, New Mexico, and South Dakota. Carney says period supplies can be expensive and hard to get in rural areas, which can put women in uncomfortable situations.
You know, wad up a lot of toilet paper or find some other rags or something else, that's problematic and can be, you know, not only embarrassing, but also is something where you feel like, you know, feel definitely a loss of dignity.
Carney says she hopes to expand the Kwek Society to more schools. I'm Claire Donnelly.
The Menominee Nation of Wisconsin filed a court appeal Thursday in a bid to protect its ancestral homeland and sacred sites from a zinc and gold mine. A Canadian company holds permits to build the Back 40 mine on the Michigan side of the Menominee River. A federal judge in December dismissed the tribe's lawsuit against the federal government. The tribe claims the government has failed in its responsibility to protect water and cultural sites and consult with the tribe by allowing the state of Michigan jurisdiction. The Indigenous Peoples March began Friday morning in Washington, D.C. People from communities around the world are drawing attention to a number of issues, including environmental protection and missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The march is taking place a day before women plan to flood the streets of Washington to highlight their concerns. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley today accused the Trump administration of intentionally planning to, quote, traumatize migrant children with family separation and expedite deportation by denying asylum hearings. A new document released today by Senator Merkley was drafted by senior officials in the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice back in 2017. Merkley is calling for an FBI investigation into whether Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen actually lied when she testified before Congress on the policy last year. That's when Secretary Nielsen said, quote, I'm not a liar. We've never had a policy for family separation.
Sudanese police fired live ammunition into a crowd of mourners as they gathered for the funeral of Moawi Othum, a 60-year-old man who died from a gunshot wound sustained at an anti-government demonstration. Friday's clashes between demonstrators and Sudanese forces are a part of the ongoing protests which started in December, on December 19th, when people took to the streets of Khartoum and Omdurman to protest against the rising prices of oil and bread. Activists and demonstrators are also calling for the resignation of long-term ruler President Omar al-Bashir. The International Criminal Court, or the ICC, has issued two warrants for Bashir's arrest. Charges include 5 counts of crimes against humanity, murder, and deliberately inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring physical destruction to targeted groups in Darfur.
Advocates and community members impacted by the Muslim ban in San Francisco deliver a petition with 70,000 signatures to Speaker Pelosi's office and hold rally demanding legislation repealing the ban. This is Middle East Plus.
I'm Esty Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. Community members, advocates, and San Francisco Bay Area residents impacted by the Trump administration's Muslim ban presented Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's office with a petition of over 70,000 signatures before holding a press conference and rally on Wednesday at the San Francisco Federal Building, urging the new Congress to introduce and support legislation that repeals Trump's racist and Islamophobic Muslim ban as the 2-year anniversary draws near. Advocates, including the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Arab Resource and Organizing Center, Empower Change, and Asian Americans Advancing Justice, are launching the Repeal the Ban campaign nationally, calling on Congress to introduce and support legislation to defund the Muslim ban before its second anniversary on January 27th. During the rally, members of the community shared their personal stories about the ways the Muslim ban has affected them. Jahan Hakim, chair of the Yemeni Alliance Committee, said, quote, I hear from my community who are impacted by the bombing in Yemen and the ban, and they not only feel helpless, they're hopeless. Thousands of spouses and children who are just surviving in the war-torn country of Yemen cannot reunite with their families who are U.S. citizens. Their cases are either stuck in administrative processing or are relying on an arbitrary waiver process, end quote. The groups involved in Wednesday's Repeal the Ban action pointed out that last November saw the election of women, immigrants, people of color, and queer people in record numbers to the U.S. Congress, and that those historic victories were driven by the efforts of marginalized communities. They argue that now is the time for Congress to stand with the most marginalized. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 18, 2019. Here are the main points again. U.S. reproductive rights are under attack across the country. Commissioner Hardesty fights for Portlanders. And Sudanese police fired live ammunition into a crowd of mourners. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Oliver Mintz-Lowe, Lisa Loving, Samuel Bowman, Tammy Habateas, and Rachel Hartley. The producer is Tammy Habateas, and our engineer and director of the Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now!, followed at 8 by the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9 o'clock, it's Alternative Radio. At 10, it's Flashpoints. Then at 11, Stage and Studio. And now it's time for a new segment here at KBOO called In the City. We will have you transported around the city for direct news in Portland. This is In the City Street News with Oliver Mintz-Lowe.
It's now day 28 of the partial government shutdown, and I'm here at PDX Airport at a rally for federal workers, where union members, workers, and other organizations are here to tell the Trump administration to open the government.
My name is Richard Kennington, and I'm with the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. I'm the local union president and represent about 30 of the air traffic controllers here.
So how are air traffic control being affected by the shutdown right now?
That's a good question. It's happening. It's being affected in a couple ways. The United States airspace is the safest, most efficient system in the world, bar none. But it is systematically being degraded day by day as this shutdown goes on. And there's a couple ways that's happening. Number one, with the staffing. We're at a 30-year low on our staffing of air traffic controllers. That means you got to go clear back to when Reagan fired 70% of the workforce in 1981. That's the kind of staffing that we're dealing with. So we're critically staffed, and this shutdown has cut off our pipeline in Oklahoma City where new air traffic controllers are trained. So there's nobody in the pipeline and will not be for the duration that this goes on. And you don't get to recoup this time that we've lost. This time is gone. These folks that were supposed to be in class will have to be rescheduled for a later time, and this group is just going to be lost. So our staffing is being definitely affected by this.
How much of an effect do you think this is having on safety right now?
Well, so that, which brings me to my next point that is being affected, is the training. Biannually, we have safety training where we take our top five safety issues and we train them. And that was supposed to start January 1, but it's not happening, and it won't as long as the shutdown goes on. So the problem is now we have to punt that off. And so that round may not happen. We may have to move on, and a critical piece of that is not going to be trained. Safety is also being compromised, and I will tell you this. I am comfortable telling you that safety in the, of the national airspace system today is not what it was 1 month ago. Another way that's happening is the redundancy in the systems, the redundancy in aviation. Everything is based on redundancy. So if one system fails, another one picks that up. But right now, we're on a fix on fail. Some of the people that are tasked with fixing the equipment when it fails have been furloughed. In addition, they can't buy new parts because there's no money appropriated to do that. In addition, not that far from us up in Seattle, 3,000 aviation professionals have been furloughed. These are folks that are responsible for putting out safety bulletins. These are the ones that they're engineers and aircraft certifiers. They certify new aircraft and that sort of thing. So these people are not on the job, and as long as they're not, the system is degraded.
So the staff that are they working without pay for the most part, or are they being paid?
So all the folks that are working are not receiving a paycheck. And for air traffic controllers, which I am, and I can speak to that aspect, that's a big safety issue. Because it's such a stressful job and it requires so much mental acuity that we tell people, when you show up, you have to be 100% dialed in. You have to leave your personal problems at the door. But that's really hard to do when you don't know if you're going to be able to meet your financial obligations. Are you going to be able to pay your mortgage? We have some single mothers who can't pay their babysitter, but they're still required to come in. They can't put the gas in the car. They don't have the money for that, but they're still required to come to work. And not only are we working 40-hour work weeks, but we talked about that staffing issue. We're working overtime on top of everything else and not receiving a paycheck for it. And that's problematic.
So what would your message be to the Trump administration now?
So our message is safety is nonpartisan. While border security is an important topic to discuss, we cannot use federal employees and the safety of our national airspace system as a political pawn. We've got to open up the government, have that debate separately, and put the safety back into the system.
So I'm here with Tom Chamberlain from Oregon AFL-CIO. Explain what you're doing here today, what everyone's doing here today.
We're out here in support of the federal workers who are either on furlough or they're working without pay. Really disappointed in Mitch McConnell. He's a majority leader in the Senate, and he needs to call for the vote because we believe there are votes there that not only would pass a bill to keep the government open, but probably sustain a veto.
So what do you think the next steps, what do you think workers should be doing in order to kind of force the administration's hand in order to get folks back to work?
We need to do things like this. We need to put pressure on the administration to get this thing done. This is exactly what we should be doing. We're out in the streets. We have a food bank about a mile from here where we fed the Labor Community Services, provided 40 pounds of food for 100 families, but we know that's not enough. People are going to be running out of their health care insurance soon. We know that meals in schools are in jeopardy.